Welcome to Reformed Rakes, a historical romance podcast that wishes you would behave with some decorum. My name is Chelsea. I'm the writer of the romance substack The Loose Cravat, a romance book collector, and book talker under the username Chelsea_ebooks.
I'm Beth. I'm a grad student, and I'm on book talk under the name Beth Haymond Reads.
I'm Emma, a law librarian writing about justice and romance at the substack Restorative Romance.
Today is a very special episode voted on by our Patreon subscribers. Thank you so much, beloved patrons. Your financial contribution helps us keep away from saucy widows and hard liquor. If you'd like bonus episodes and book recommendations, you too can become a patron at patreon.com/reformedrakes. Last year, we did a taxonomy of rakes, where we dived into different types of historical romance heroes awash in debauchery. Rakes get a lot of love, and not just because they're promiscuous, but they're not the only historical romance hero that's deserving of the spotlight. Some of the most interesting and memorable characters we've met didn't need to be reined in. They needed to cut loose. A starchy hero is uptight, obsessed with morals and propriety, and often a bit awkward in company. He's often an aristocrat who puts too much value in his social standing and doesn't take enough time to smell the roses. With the help of a love interest, his entire world will be shaken up, until White's is no longer his favorite club, and suddenly, maybe frolicking through the trees seems like a good idea. The name of this episode is lovingly pulled from the Goodreads list of the same title, and while I don't agree with every entry in there, I still think it is a work of art. With that in mind, Beth, Emma, and I are paying homage by bringing you an episode that categorizes some of our top starchy heroes, men who are about to finally meet their match. This whole episode is going to be about our favorite starchy heroes, so instead of asking you about their appeal, I thought I'd ask why you think historical romance is synonymous with rakes rather than their more staid counterparts.
I feel like both of these character types involve like a shifting worldview, but maybe with the rake, it's much more dramatic. And then also there is like, we use starchy and we have a Goodreads starchy list, but it's not like, how do you put that in a book title? Like the Duke guy in starched. I don't know.
You can't make a pun off of it, though. Someone will probably get an idea now, and well, that'll be like the new trend of pun titles.
Boring Duke gets personality.
Right.
So I was thinking that maybe a rake as a hero feels confined to historical romance. So like, if maybe this association is stronger there because like maybe we don't hear that word in things that aren't historical romance, or it's very clearly a reference to historical romance. Like the thing where people say like things that are sexy in a book but would annoy me in real life, I associate those behaviors with like rakish behaviors. But I feel like we could know people who are starchy and tolerate them and love them. And like, I just associate that sort of like, I want to keep it in my fiction much stronger with rakes. But I think the idea that you could be someone's undoing because they're so uptight or upright is maybe a little bit more appealing in real life and other genres. So then the connection between historical romance and starchy heroes is lesser. Though I also think, like, I mean, I hesitate to say that Jane Austen is like the start of all historical romance. I think that's sometimes a one-to-one connection that people draw too strongly. But Jane Austen loves a starchy hero. Like most of, I think, I would characterize maybe all, maybe not Henry Tilney, but I think the other five are kind of starchy compared to their counterparts. So I think that connection is very strong. She doesn't let the rakes win in her novels.
This is true. Although she does let them explain themselves, which I appreciate. I feel like, yes, she allows like nuance to her characters that like modern histrom, yeah, is like not interested in.
Right. Well, yeah, you're only a rake if you're reformed by the end. Right.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the things that I've found about historical romance rake is that like a reformed rake, we categorize that as a specific type of rake, but really the reformed rake is the monogamous rake, whereas, yeah, like a starchy hero, except for one specific category, I think they're more inclined to be monogamous, but it's just kind of like, it's more of like the judgmental nature that they have that kind of needs to be shaken up a little bit in order for them to actually find love. All right, so for this recommendation episode, we divided the starchy heroes into different categories so we could talk about them kind of as a group. So our first category is the political category. These men are sometimes members of parliament, sometimes barristers, but they have an interest in ascension where they have to keep a keen eye out for who their partner is to reach their goals. When starchy heroes are political, they are less inclined to be awkward and are more calculating. But that calculation becomes a risk assessment for love that is a barrier to the AGA. So the first book I have here is Dance by Judy Cuevas, who you'll later know as Judith Ivory. Dance is set in the turn of the century France. Sebastian is from an old aristocratic family, and he's one of the most powerful people in the country. He's a well-respected lawyer, and thanks to a business partnership with a new money upstart, Monsieur de Garde, he's also very, very rich. Sebastian had a one-night stand with Marie de Garde, his business partner's daughter, years earlier. In the first pages of the book, she's newly returned to France after living in America, and Sebastian is sent to pick her up and take her to her father's house. The Marie he knew was a blur, a bit timid, so he's shocked by her when she returns. Her skirts are too short, she smokes, she has an effortless cool and confidence that discombobulates him. He can't even muster up a decent amount of disapproval for her. She fascinates him. Marie is now a filmmaker, and when she gets cut off from her father for her errant ways, she leaves Sebastian's circles entirely. Now he has to hunt for her. Sebastian is a very proper, correct type of person. He's like the pillar of his community, someone who makes judgment calls and doesn't step out of line. Getting reintroduced to the newly bohemian Marie absolutely rocks his world. Even when he's not near her, he's shocking himself by his thoughts. There's this one scene where he's giving a speech to suffragettes and he has a sort of psychosexual meltdown at an ice cream social. It's incredible. The best way to encapsulate this book and Sebastian would be through this quote from when Marie is giving him the brush off. And so this is Sebastian's point of view. They continue to talk for perhaps another 15 minutes. Marie leaned toward him at one point, not close to do anything, mind you. Yet it seemed so obvious all at once. Taunt the prude. Taunt the fool. She was leading him on a little dance here in the countryside. She was intentionally baiting him. Sebastian chatted and laughed. He led her, faintly intrigued, faintly annoyed. How dare she feel so safe? How dare she forget? He was modest, selective, sexually reticent, but he was not shy once he understood whom he wanted and the ground rules of the sexual negotiation. She had forgotten that he could make love in the same way he did everything else, in an orderly manner, to a well-orchestrated end, methodically, relentlessly, cleverly.
So I'm going to talk about another book that starts with an assassination years ago. I'm going to talk about Delicious by Sherry Thomas. So like so many of Thomas's books, Delicious has a dual timeline for our romance. Verity is a cook and was a mistress of her late employer, Bertie, though their relationship ended before he died. When the estate passes to his half-brother, Stuart, Verity has to confront her past with him. They had an anonymous assassination years ago that was so passionate that Stuart proposed, an uncharacteristic leap of faith by the staid MP who was trying to be prime minister. Verity had approached him a decade ago as a part of an elaborate blackmail plan to try and secure her illegitimate son's future after Bertie refuses to marry her. Verity is secretly the daughter of a duke, but her death has been faked in society after her son was born. Stuart is currently engaged to a young woman who he mostly feels platonic, avuncular affection for. When Stuart arrives at Bertie's estate, he's overwhelmed by Verity's cooking, with his reaction surprising himself in its sensuality, to the point where he initially sends the food away. She keeps her face a secret from him through a variety of contrived efforts, though he tolerates it because he's so enamored with both her cooking and her presence. It helps that Verity can speak French and pretends to be French as the cook. There are quite a few subplots here involving the secret baby, who's now a young man, there's a secondary romance, and the dual timeline with flashbacks to Verity and Stuart's first meeting. But Stuart's starchiness is really defined by his denial of pleasure. Bertie was an indulgent, and Stuart sees himself as the anti-Bertie. He feels like his success is because of his denial of pleasure. But he's also immediately interested in indulging Verity's pleasure, the inverse of her relationship with Bertie. Stuart does not consider himself a very sensual person, so a lot of his romantic acts towards Verity are unstudied, but just natural responses to her. For example, when they first have sex, he realizes that her hands are working hands, and he's enamored with her calluses and kisses them. This sounds kind of awkward, but in the moment, it's just him being overwhelmed by her, and it really works in the book. Stuart's political aspirations are ultimately not hurt by his union with Verity because of her noble background, but he does make it clear that he would marry her anyway.
The final book in this category is The Duke by Galen Foley. Belle starts off the book as a school teacher to aristocratic young ladies, but when she rebuffs the advances of a baronet she meets at a country ball, he makes it his mission to make her so destitute that she has no choice but to reconsider. The baronet, Dolph, gets her father thrown into Fleet for his debts and causes Belle to lose her job. Belle tries to make a living as a costermonger, but when the warden at Fleet finds out she lives alone, he follows her home and violently assaults her. Belle decides at that moment that she needs money and protection, and she seeks out an infamous Cyprian, Harriet, to tutor her. Cyprians are not just courtesans. They're the highest tier, and because they're so sought after, courtship is more like a game than an exchange. After some convincing, Harriet agrees to take Belle under her wing. Meanwhile, Robert, the Duke of Hawkscliffe, is mooning over the death of his lost love, Lucy. He believes that Dolph is involved with Lucy's death, and he decides to enlist Belle in his revenge scheme, since Dolph is still so obsessed with her, and Belle also wants revenge. Robert is an infamous Tory leader called the Paragon Duke for his lack of vices. His politics, particularly his desire to rein in the death penalty as punishment, are always being called out as being more in line with the Whig Party, but he balks at this, saying that the Hawkscliffe Dukes have always been Tories and they always will be. As the Paragon Duke, Robert is very, very judgmental of sex work, and early on in his acquaintance with Belle, he makes that very clear, which makes her feel lonely and shamed. Soon after, the hammer of love comes down hard on Robert, and he becomes so believably smitten with Belle that he's practically skipping through life. He adores her and dotes on her, and she comfortably settles into a political hostess role. But things aren't really all well. Belle, the great love of Robert's life, has a painful secret that she doesn't trust him with, because why would she let herself be vulnerable with a man who has made such disparaging remarks about her and her occupation? The reckoning Robert has with his own behavior in order to get that HEA is truly remarkable. So something that while we were reading these summaries, I noticed a connection between the Duke and Delicious that I don't think I had noticed before. So when you described Stuart as being the anti-Bertie, that's actually something that happens in the Duke. Robert's mother, she had the nickname the Hawkscliffe Harlot. She had like 7 kids by like 5 different people. And so Robert and his brother are nicknamed the Knight Miscellany. And that is kind of heavily implied where Robert gets his like really intense feelings about shame with sex and with and it's kind of implied where like a lot of his like misogyny comes from the way that his mother was treated and the way that he feels about his mother. So he kind of is like putting himself forth as like, no, I'm not really my mother's son. I'm not like her. I need to model my behavior the correct way, not after her. But like in doing that, he's really doing his mother a disservice. And there's like a scene where Belle is like, she actually seemed fine. Like, I don't know why you're doing this. So I thought that was kind of funny that there's kind of like, there's like this family member, there's this some person that you're kind of like, I don't have the relationship with them that I want, because like Bertie and Stuart, like I think there's like an, Sherry Thomas makes it very clear that like they both kind of wanted something but didn't really know how to make it happen.
That happens in Dance too, because Sebastian has Nardi. So it's about, this Dance is the sequel to Bliss, which is Sebastian's younger brother's book. And Nardi, the hero of that book, is so dissipated in the book that like when I first read it, I didn't even realize that he was the hero of the book, because I was like, how could this guy be the hero of this book?
He throws up in a piano.
He's so off the walls. Like, it's like, how could he redeem himself? I thought Sebastian was the hero of Bliss when I first read it. So yeah, I think, yeah, the framing of like, I'm the anti this person. And I think also the political heroes, they feel like, I think they have to define themselves as like, I didn't just like luck into being the first son or whatever position they're in that allows them to be the title holder. They have to think like, it's something innate in my personality. And like, it's something other than like fate of birth order that has given this to me. Because if it's not that, then like, what do I have if I am indulgent like my brother, if I am dissipated, if I treat women this way? I'm not deserving of this. I have, in order to justify this like fate that has put me in a better position than my brother, I have to be like a noble man. And it's like, how do I do that while falling in love? It can be tough.
I feel like so much of starchiness is social rules. And I feel like this political starchy, it's like you have your regular set of like social rules, and then added on top is the political layer of it, where it's not just like how they feel about it. They're very aware of how people perceive them because they do have these political aspirations. The only one I've read is Delicious. And I see that. And we kind of mentioned like all these couples kind of fall in love early. It's just like managing how things are supposed to look, or like the political starchy, like Stuart in this case, kind of getting over how he, because he wants to be prime minister. He's currently an MP. So he wants a wife that would look good for him politically, and Verity is like not that person. So I think that's like a fairly common conflict in this type of political starchy.
I think this comes up in all three books. I've definitely read the first two, and I think I've read The Duke. As Chels was talking about the book, I was like, I think I've read this. I think I read it for Newgate and then realized it was Fleet, and so I didn't do a deep dive on it. But I think also, because this comes up in later books, all three of these couples, I think, consider not being married and just having like a relationship of like, you're my mistress. Because sometimes in other books that we're going to talk about, that's like off the table for like, they're so starchy that like, I won't even have a mistress. But this is like, oh, this could be a solution if we weren't actually in love. Because I think there's some level of denial of like, what's the extent of my feelings?
Right.
Or not even denial of feelings, but like, how can I do a compromise? Can you be my mistress? And can I be married to someone else in order to have these like political aspirations? And that ends up being unsatisfactory to either one or both members of the couple. But also like, I think unites them.
Yeah. And what makes Dance so interesting about that is because it's actually, Sebastian is the one that wants to get married, because like for him being married to somebody is better than him just like having an affair or being obsessed, having a psychosexual meltdown at ice cream socials. Like something is really clearly wrong with him. And he's kind of like needs to keep Marie in his life, but doesn't really know how. And he doesn't really know how to talk to her. But he's just like, this is something that I really need to happen. I'm scared that you're going to leave me. But it also is like how he envisions like a complete life is for this like kind of marriage to come around. Whereas like for the other two, they're like, you are not a person that I can go forward and marry comfortably. Like you are not a person that I have, everything that I've been working towards is going to be wrecked with this marriage. So that they have that that mistress conversation that ends kind of differently for each type of book. Like Belle, obviously, she starts off as Robert's mistress, or she's his fake mistress for part of the book because like they're doing it kind of like undercover. But like he eventually crosses a line that makes that relationship untenable for them. But yeah, no, this was a really interesting one. I think that they're not usually the first types of heroes that I think about when I think about starchy heroes, but like they usually have like some of the like most intense groveling too, is kind of what I've noticed, or the most intense about face.
I think something else, like, it's not true for all three of these books, but I know it's true for quite a few that were coming up. But for The Duke and Dance, we didn't mention this in the Dance summary, but Sebastian was previously married. And I think starchy heroes are much more likely to have had like a partner before than a rake. And I think that's one thing I like about it is that because it's like one of my favorite parts of some of the later books that we're going to talk about is that the person that they were with before is like a person, even if they weren't like their great love of their lives, or that they were just a mistress that they sort of like Wulfric Bedwin, we're going to talk about later, has a mistress that he has great affection for who's passed away. Sebastian's wife is sort of like a marriage of convenience, but he's like sad that she's dead, even if he wasn't in love with her. It's like this past woman is a person, because I feel like rakes obviously had past women, but a lot of times those women are like anonymous or very flat characters, or like cardboard cutouts of like a courtesan or a sex worker or a mistress or a widow. There's not a lot of like mourning going on for that relationship. And I think this just makes like, it's like a little less reductive of these women that were defined the men before we came to their romance.
Yeah, I agree.
Judith Ivory, I feel like a lot of her characters have had a prior marriage. I think that's like something I tend to expect more with her.
Sebastian and Marie in Dance are both older. Mm-hmm. Like they're kind of 30s. Old when they first have sex. Like they're not like young people. And then when they come back together later, they're like, they're both grown-ups, which is, it's nice. And you really feel that in the book.
Mm-hmm. Are most starchy characters, are they older? Do we think that? Just from like what you're saying, I feel like rakes kind of tend to be younger, maybe. Not always. I'm sure we could come up with contradictory examples, but it feels like the starchy ones are typically older.
Yeah. I usually think like mid to late 30s is usually what I think mm-hmm. of. Although I think the counterexample is Ruined by Rumor. Alex, wasn't he? He seemed quite young to me.
Yeah, he might have been like 25.
Yeah.
But you're right. Like, yeah, he's a young dude. But he's in the category of like, he's been in love with
He's been in love for so long, it aged him prematurely.
Yeah.
To the starchy man he needed to become.
Yeah.
Awesome. Our next category is called the bodyguard. The bodyguard category is a distinct type of starchy hero. These are men that have a mission, which often overlaps with protecting the heroine. So a starchy bodyguard is single-minded and correct to the point where they might miss out on love if they can't break a few rules.
Yeah, so the first book I want to talk about is The Butterfly Bride by Vanessa Riley. So this is the third book in a series. It's very interconnected. So we kind of meet the couple in media res of their flirtation. The couple is Frederica Burgley, the illegitimate daughter of a duke, and Jasper Fitzwilliam, a widowed viscount in the middle of a year-long flirtation. Frederica's mother was a black courtesan, so Frederica is doubly aware that her reputation is precarious, though she's naturally flirtatious and fun to be around. So she always has sort of men buzzing around her, including Jasper, who's been like following her around for a year. Frederica had previously placed an advertisement seeking marriage in a newspaper, but this led to someone becoming fixated on her, and the book opens with her room being broken into. Her father's also trying to marry her off to one of his friends, so she's really looking for a husband very quickly. Frederica's father loves her, but he speaks to her in a way that constantly reminds her that she's not quite the status she would be if she were a white, legitimate daughter. This gives her pause at asking anything of Jasper, and she assumes her race and status are what makes him feel like he should and constantly correct her behavior. Jasper has nursed a crush on her for about a year, but his widowed status, he very much loved his wife and now has three daughters to raise, and Frederica's flirtatious nature meant he preferred to keep things platonic. At least he thinks that's what he wants. When Frederica's father goes on his honeymoon to his new wife, Jasper finds himself volunteering to look after Frederica, which means moving her into his brother's home and investigating who was trying to hurt her. Most of the men around Frederica, including her father, think the best that she can do is be a nobleman's mistress, thinking that this is a better position for her than a lower class man who would be willing to marry a mixed race woman, even as the daughter of a duke. Jasper's unstarching primarily comes through understanding Frederica always will be on for a crowd as a defense mechanism for assumptions that she knows will be drawn about her by everyone, including Jasper. Jasper's perception of the world at the beginning of the book could possibly be described as like well-meaningly colorblind. He is frequently aghast when men say racist things to him about Frederica, and he has to realize how his behavior could be interpreted by her to reinforce the worst thing she's ever heard about herself.
Okay, so my book is Nighthawk by Beverly Jenkins. It's set in Kansas in 1889. As is typical of a Jenkins heroine, we have Maggie, who works hard. Her boss's son attempts to assault her, and in defense, she hits him and he falls down, but he does die. So the sheriff intends to take her by train to Kansas City to see one of the circuit judges. Hank Langley, this is her boss and the father of the man who tried to assault her, follows them to the train station and wants to hand out justice to Maggie. The sheriff ends up arresting Langley for impeding the train and assaulting peace officers. And our hero, Ian, he's on the train and he has been deputized as a marshal. The sheriff knows this, so he asks Ian to take Maggie to Kansas City since he now has to take Langley back home. So a bit more on Ian. He's Scottish and trained as a barrister. He is biracial. I think his father is Scottish and his mother, she is a black woman. So he moves to the States as an adult and he can't get a job. He changes his name. He becomes a bounty hunter under the pseudonym Preacher. He and Maggie are having a conversation and she says to him, "Oh, you really are a preacher." And he tells her, "No, I'm a man who used the Bible to overcome the murder of my wife." So Ian grew up Catholic, but his wife Tilda was fairly religious. A bit of history on them. They slept in different beds because she didn't believe in sharing one with him unless it was for sex, and she didn't really like sex. So this is Ian's point of view and a quote from the book. "So out of respect for her sensibilities, he hadn't approached her very often. Yet, and still, she'd been the sweetest, most loving person he'd ever met. And because of her, he'd given up his outlaw ways in order to win her hand. After her death, he'd shed the easygoing lover of life he'd once been, and a more dour, humorless man had taken his place." Again, as is kind of typical of Jenkins, most of the conflict is external. Ian and Maggie have some push and pull throughout the book, but they do get married about two-thirds of the way through, so that's just in time for a third act kidnapping. I find this book kind of fascinating through the lens of Ian becoming unstarched, where it's both his marriage and the love of his first wife that kind of makes him starchy. I feel like another romance novelist would be tempted to downplay Ian's first marriage. I think he eventually has a revelation that he and Maggie are better suited, and she kind of brings out the passion in him. but Ian still genuinely grieves his first wife. And I kind of like that he adopts religion after her death as part of his grief. And it's not something he sheds to be unstarched.
So I'm going to talk about one more book in this category. So this one is A Fallen Lady by Elizabeth Kingston. Lady Helen De Haven was in love and engaged to be married, but when she and her fiancé are found in an amorous position, she actually refuses to marry him at all, rather than accept the suggestion of her family to move up the marriage. Since then, she's been living quietly in a village off of a very small allowance, with no contact with her brother, the Earl of Whitemarsh. But he now wants to know the truth, so he sends Stephen, the Earl of Summerdale, to investigate. Stephen has a reputation for knowing things about people, so Alex, the brother, assumes that Stephen will be able to root out the truth and piece it together with his other knowledge. Alex is interested in reconciling with Helen at the encouragement of his new wife, but only if he can discover the truth and if she was actually blameless. Stephen is prepared to think of Helen as a fallen woman, but sees how happy she is in her little life in the village. He's quickly enamored with her, but Helen has a fear of physical affection that early on suggests that the amorous embrace that she was discovered in was less than wanted on her end. Helen also accuses Stephen of attempting to seduce her in order to prove society's judgments against her. Stephen holds her in high esteem and is confused by her seeming propriety. Helen also complicates matters when she goes to him and ends up offering sex in exchange for a loan. She needs the money to help a child that's a subplot. Stephen eventually proposes marriage instead. Really, the unstarching that happens here is Stephen having to realize that no one, including women, are all good or all bad. He's so enamored with Helen when he first meets her that he thinks there must be more to the story, but when she refuses to disclose that information and then propositions him, he's really ready to dismiss her like the rest of the world. She eventually does reveal what happened to her fiancé. She had discovered her fiancé doing something incredibly cruel, though it takes her longer to reveal that the fiancé had also attempted to rape her. That's when they are discovered. Stephen is able to discover this when he overhears her talking to the fiancé when the fiancé comes to visit and distresses Helen. Stephen has to work through his binary worldview crashing down when he realizes the extent of his feelings for Helen.
I forgot how much plot is in A Fallen Lady, because when you're like talking about that he does something so cruel, it's like, yeah, he, it's like it's like murder.
Yeah, he I wasn't sure if I would have included my my summary or not, because it's like a whole other plot. He kills like itinerant people on his lands.
Yeah,
like she finds him killing people.
Yeah,
and then he attempts to rape her, and then they're discovered, and everyone's like, "You have to marry him," and she's like, "I absolutely will not be doing that."
Yeah,
but she also knows that he won't get in trouble for the murders, so she doesn't want to like tell what happened because it's like not gonna do anything. And she's so distressed by not being believed or sort of being ostracized that she doesn't trust her brother anymore.
Understandably.
There's a lot of plot. Yeah. And there's the secret, the baby that she's helping.
It's like
that's a whole thing.
Yeah. It just surprised me. I thought it'd be like more straightforward. Sorry, this is getting off the rails. It's just you were reading the plot and it reminded me of this book. But everyone should read Elizabeth Kingston. She's very good.
Yeah, the book is great. And the starchy Stephen becoming unstarched is enjoyable. There's just a lot of stuff going around it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think anything kind of like ties these three books together? Like hearing them kind of laid out.
I feel like advocating for their like eventual wives is like a thing. I think it's like I haven't read The Butterfly Bride, but it seems like a steep learning curve for Jasper, where it's like he just has no idea. And as he encounters those remarks, he's like, oh, that's why she acts this way. It's armor. Like, she has to be this way.
Yeah, this was my first Vanessa Riley, and I'd like to read more by her because I think I tend to judge the first book I read by an author the most harshly, because I think getting used to their style of like dialogue and like when it's different from other things that I've read, I think sometimes I'm like, I'm not sure what to do with it. But the level of research that she puts into like how people talk about race in the Regency, I think is like, it's so spot on. Honestly, it's like what I would recommend. I know Jenkins, I think almost all of her books are set in America.
Yeah.
But like the level of author's notes, like research that Riley does is absurd. And Riley's blog that she writes about the research that she does is like impeccable. And I've used it for other things. But one thing I really liked about the book was like the level that there's like scales of racism happening in the book. Frederica's father obviously falls in love with a black woman. That's how Frederica comes to exist. But he still has this sort of like more benign level of racism, that he like cares about his daughter a lot, but he says these things that are extremely distressing to her, but he's less racist than other people who are like more villainous in the book. And like also like the dialogue and the way people could sort of perceive it it was just very like fleshed out. But I think that connects The Butterfly Bride and The Fallen Lady is that neither hero really understands like why the heroine would act this way, like what defense mechanisms they would need, like why would someone read them in bad faith? And it's like, oh, because they're women. And also in the Butterfly Bride's case, she's mixed race. And so they both have to learn that like maybe the stakes are different for someone else. And like that is what causes people to not be able to follow these rules that you find so stringent. Like it's a big reveal in the, for Jasper and the Butterfly Bride to realize that Frederica maybe has to be like really flirty and on all the time and always be performing because that keeps people like on her side. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, she's a flirt. And like that sort of dynamic really reminded me of The Earl I Ruined by Scarlett Peckham, right, where he's very judgmental of her flirtatiousness. And that's also a defense mechanism. But in Frederica's case, it's even more of like a self-preservation. Like she's in danger because of her race. And Jasper has to realize that.
Jenkins is also good at this. Like you mentioned that she has extensive author notes and she draws a lot on the historical aspect. I think one thing Jenkins is really good at is teaching the reader the history of the time as like the characters are conveying this history to each other, because it's like America is so big. And if you have one character who's like has this type of background, like Ian has settled in Wyoming, obviously Maggie's from Kansas, as they like relate their family histories to each other, you also get this like societal history, and like it helps inform like why these characters act the way that they do. So that's one thing I really appreciate about Jenkins.
Yeah, I liked that Riley, she gives us a year. I always appreciate when people give us a year.
Please, and then give us also years.
Like, there's this like historical moments that happen. So it's 1820. And it's like very specifically when George the Fourth becomes king. So it's no longer the regency. George the Third is dead. He's no longer the prince regent. He's now the king. And there are all these things that like happen in the book that sort of indicate like, oh, we are out of this like sort of 14-year period of like things being in between, or we're like not sure what's going to happen. We now have a king who's an adult who's not crazy. And he's also moving towards, like, we're moving towards, like, the end of the regency when things become more staid. Like, we're prepping for Victorian period. So I think that makes sense why Jasper is, like, so invested in rules, like, differently than a someone who, like, is, like, a 1798 book or even an 1800 book. Like, we're 20 years later and we're going towards the 19th century and we're, like, firmly there.
I also think it's interesting that both these books, Nighthawk and The Butterfly Bride, feature like racial minorities. It feels like this extra layer as well of roles you have to navigate, and that we're uniting them through this like bodyguard starchy character. And I think that is where it's like it makes a lot of sense to me that you have these like minority characters that eventually are advocating, like on the advocating end of things for like their partner.
Yeah, and Butterfly Bride and A Fallen Lady too, they both end up getting married. Like they're sort of protecting the person, and then they're like, well, we just have to get married. Right. And then they get married and then have to reveal their marriage to people. They're, both books have scenes where they're like, you didn't marry her, did you? And then he's like, yeah, I did.
Right.
Can't do anything now. She's my wife.
The next category, this is maybe our most fun category, and we're calling it Stop Embarrassing Me. So this is a starchy hero that has a strict set of rules for himself and is absolutely, utterly, completely devastated to find himself in love with someone so thoroughly unsuitable. Love is always embarrassing, but it's doubly so for these characters. So the first book I have is At the Bride Hunt Ball by Olivia Parker. We've talked before about rom-coms and historical romance, and now there's this negative connotation because a lot of books that are pitched that way aren't actually romantic or funny. At the Bride Hunt Ball has something that a lot of books pitched as rom-coms don't. It's charming as hell, and the couple has chemistry. So it's a very silly setup. Gabriel is a duke who never wants to marry because he's worried that nobody will ever meet his exacting expectations, and he'll therefore make any wife miserable. He decides that instead of getting married, he'll marry off his younger, rakish brother, Tristan, so that Tristan will be responsible for making heirs and continuing the family line. Tristan is not mentally or emotionally ready to court a woman for marriage, so Gabriel has a bachelor-style house party where he invites a select group of women, and there will eventually be a rose ceremony where Tristan selects his bride. As a side note, like, I didn't connect the rose ceremony thing to the bachelor, even though I had been calling this a bachelor style until I was writing this, and I was like, oh. That's so funny. So Madeline is probably the least suitable woman at the party, and Gabriel is constantly thinking about how inappropriate her presence is, but he's also constantly thinking about her. She's half American, she's too loud and is always getting into scrapes, and she doesn't have the svelte figure he imagines the perfect aristocratic lady would have. But he wants her so bad, he is constantly chasing her around this house party for reasons that he won't admit to himself. Meanwhile, Madeline is only attending the house party because her stepmother is forcing her to, and she's beyond tired of people acting like her natural state is too embarrassing to be around. So when Gabriel overcomes that shame and embarrassment to reach for what he truly wants, it might actually be too late. The charm of At the Bride Hunt Ball is that even if it's referential, it's not in a winking at the audience type of way, rose ceremony and all. It's a book that puts chemistry first, which is probably why I reread it so often.
I was just going to ask. I'm like, I feel like this is one of Chelsea's rereads.
Yes, I have like heard this title. So I was like, I've heard this title so often. I was like, no, it's just Chelsea. It's really just which I think I thought I had read this book, but I don't think I have. I think Anne Mallory has a book with a similar plot, and I've read that one. Yes. The Bride.
Hers is
something
less goofy, but...
Less goofy. Yeah. It's much more. There's anguish in it. This sounds goofy and fun, but sorry, I should read this.
I adore it. And then the next book in this category I have is Slightly Dangerous by Mary Ballag. So Slightly Dangerous is the absolute ultimate starchy hero book. It's the one we reference the most often on this podcast, and it's also my favorite Mary Ballag book. Christine Derrick has been widowed for a few years. Her last marriage was a failure because she didn't easily fit in with the members of the aristocracy. Christine's exuberance is just shy of being cloying. She's happy-go-lucky and amenable in a way that draws people to her, but doesn't necessarily amount for good Tom. Even though she's happy with her new life as a country teacher, Christine's friend is throwing a house party, and she begs Christine to attend so that she has an even number of men and women. This is where Christine meets Wulfric Bedwin, the Duke of Bucastle. Historical romance has no shortage of dukes, but if there was an award for the most duke, it would go to Wulfric. He's aloof, annoyed at being approached by people who want things from him, has a profile that's described as hawkish, and he condescendingly peers down at the masses through his quizzing glass. The last thing in the world he wants is to be around Christine Derrick, a woman who doesn't know how to behave. At the house party, Christine has a number of mishaps. Her dress rips when she falls out of a tree, she's inappropriately enthusiastic during charades, and she's a bad horsewoman. Wulfric is extremely embarrassed and annoyed by these occurrences, but he finds himself experiencing an attraction that he doesn't know what to do with, and he continuously throws himself in Christine's path against his better judgment. But dukes don't always get what they want. When Wulfric condescends to court Christine, she throws it back in his face. Why should she be content to live with someone who doesn't view her as an equal? It's a long, humbling, uphill battle for Wulfric, and it's such a joy to read, and it's an amazing work by Ballag. And so before we end this category to chat more, Emma has read a lot of Ballag books. And so we kind of created a mini category for this that's just Ballag because she does this hero a lot.
Yes. So I do agree with Chels that Wulfric is like the ultimate version of this. But if Mary Ballag likes something, she will do it over and over again. And so she has like this riff on a starchy hero. And I realized after I wrote the plots out of all these books, they're all people who are new to being earls, who are trying so hard to follow the rules. While Wulfric is like firmly sort of cased in being a duke, all the heroes in the next three books I'm going to talk about are new earls, and they feel much more tenuous. So The Secret Mistress, which I think is the earliest book I'm going to talk about, Edward, the new and unexpected Earl of Hayward, his brother died in a carriage accident, thinks that Angeline is a hoyden, doesn't realize he needs a hoyden. He also thinks that she thinks he's a stick in the mud, and which she does think. She absolutely describes him that way. I think she calls him a dry stick in the book. But he doesn't realize that she wants to marry a stick in the mud because her brothers are rakes and her father was a rake. Angeline sees a staid, starchy man as a guarantee to happiness because he won't cheat on her and he won't die in a carriage race. Angeline is one of my favorite Ballag heroines, and this book is really sort of an exploration of a starchy hero getting unstarched sort of against his will totally because he keeps sort of wanting to protect this woman who keeps putting herself in what he considers danger, which she considers like a good time. The next one is The Proposal, which is basically like a class flipped Slightly Dangerous. I think I read these books near each other. And then also Wulfric and Christine appear in The Proposal and give advice to the couple. So it's again, one of those sort of like self-referential Ballag moments. Hugo is an earl, but he's made an earl after the Napoleonic Wars, so he feels really out of place as a noble person. And so he's very starchy because he's newly aristocratic. He has been told the rules of the aristocracy, and he's like, I'm going to follow them like I would follow the rules of the army. Gwendolyn is a widow of an abusive husband. They were both from noble families, and she was disabled indirectly by her husband's abuse. So she's really interested in doing what widows do, which is have affairs without consequences. She wants to have a good time because her marriage was so terrible. Hugo doesn't fully get how to do that. So when they start an affair, he insists on proposing to keep up propriety. And she won't marry again unless it's for love. He's less worried about her behavior as much as the behavior she inspires in him that could hurt his new position. And then the last one I have is Someone to Wed. In this one, the heroine, Ren, has a port wine birthmark that has led to her being abandoned by her family to an aunt and uncle with no children. But this makes her an heiress of their factory interest. She's basically, at the beginning of the book, attempting to buy a husband. And so she lands on the very starchy Alex Westcott, who's a new earl, and he's very poor. He inherits an earldom and a house, but no money. He wants to do things right, so he's going to court her. Even though he knows he needs the money, she wants him to do a marriage of convenience. He's like, that's not what's done. I'm going to court you. So it's a lot of the book is Alex thinking, like, this is just what you do when you court someone, and Ren wondering why they have to do all the pretense. And the answer is that Alex is deeply in love with Ren almost immediately. So those are all of Mary Wallach's, like, little earls. And I think in Someone to Wed and The Proposal, Wulfric shows up to, like, be in the distance, and the men are like, he's so great. He's what I want to be.
It's because he's the ultimate.
The most. Right.
All these earls, like, seeing a duke and be like, man, Wulfric's the best.
Think about Wulfric all the time.
He's a great character. I was surprised when I read this book last out of the three of us. And yeah, I feel like this category could also, you could almost read any of these heroines, or at least the two books. I don't know about all the Balog books, but I feel like very easily that you could have like a neurodivergent heroine in this category. If you wanted to read it that way, it doesn't mean like that the heroine is definitely neurodivergent, but I feel like that could be a potential reading for some of those. And I feel like it kind of adds to the stop embarrassing me part of it.
That's interesting because I think when I read the proposal, that I felt like Hugo was neurodivergent because he's so invested in like received rules. He's like, why? Because part of their dynamic in that book is that Gwendolyn, she's like, yeah, there are rules, but like if you're noble, you can kind of, there's like when you know to break them, it's like, okay. She's like, it's fine that we slept together. We don't need to get married. The subtleties of like, I'm a widow. It was a one-time thing. Like, that's fine. Hugo doesn't get that. He's like, well, like, why would I sleep with a noble woman who I'm not going to marry? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, that's not what you do. So I think that sort of like subtleties, I feel like it works as like a metaphor for neurodivergency where Hugo is like, why would there be a secret set of other rules that are like unspoken? Like if you've told me these rules, those are the rules I'm going to follow.
I feel like any of the starchy characters could be like neurodivergent or like autistic because just like, okay, but this is the rules. You told me the rules. I'm beholden to the rules.
One of my favorite Wulfric moments is he's like, it's the afternoon and he's like, the afternoon is when he spent looking over his papers, but he didn't have any papers to look at. So he's like, I don't know what to do.
Oh my God.
He's like at a loss for like how to spend his time. He's like, my schedule's off.
Or you could even say the reason that he shows up to the house party, right? I think that was like another character that also kind of reads as neurodivergent where he's like, he's telling Wulfric about this house party that's really a party for like a young couple, an engagement ball party for a young couple. So something that Wulfric does not want to be anywhere like 20 feet, 30 feet. He doesn't want to be anywhere near that.
Right.
And the guy who's pitching to him is just like, oh yeah, my sister's having this party. It's a gathering for intellectuals. We're going to just be intellectuals together at this party. And Wulfric is like, well, I do need to get out of the house and I am an intellectual, so I am going to show up there. And then he gets to the house party and there's just like all these like giggling young girls who are like trying to talk to him. And he's like, no.
They're going to be games.
No, he's just like losing his mind.
I feel like this category is like the most Darcy coded of all the categories. Like, I don't know. Also because Wulfric is very like Darcy coded as well. To me, at least. I don't know how.
I think a lot of people think that, particularly because he has the botched proposal, just like like a very kind of similar way.
No, I can see that. I can see why people say that. I guess I just, his overall...
His character.
Okay. Like, his overall character just kind of reads that way to me. And him being, like, more beholden to social rules, like, Darcy was kind of that way. Mm-hmm. Also, you could read Darcy as, like, neurodivergent, too. So to me, yeah. I'm like, these are all potential different readings.
That makes sense. One thing that I love about at the Bride Hunt Ball and Slightly Dangerous, and I think kind of, like, comes with a lot of the stop embarrassing me type characters, yeah. is that, like, their hijinks are really ramped up because the authors are like, we have to make this as horrible for this starchy character as humanly possible. And that's kind of, I think, where, like, a lot of the rom-communist of At the Bride Hunt Ball comes in, because a lot of it is, like, the hijinks that Madeline gets into. Like, she gets stung in the butt with the bee, and then she, like, falls out of a window, and then, like, her dresses are too small. And it's very, like, it reminded me a lot of, like, something that I would see Sandra Bullock do. Like, it was just charming in a way that, like, I don't always find these scenarios charming. Similarly, I said in Slightly Dangerous that Christine is, like, just shy of cloying. In less deft hands, this character would be insufferable. Yeah. But Christine is so fun. And I love Christine.
Yeah, I think for The Secret Mistress, lots of people find Angeline insufferable. She is one of Mary Bollock's, like, revisited heroines. Like, the book is actually a prequel to her two brothers, the Rakes, get their books, the first, and then Angeline is in those two books being insufferable. And both of those books, the brothers are like, I don't really understand my sister's marriage. Like, Edward is so boring. Why did she marry him? And then Mary Bollock writes the prequel to be like, this is why she married him. And it's very cute. But a lot of people read this book and they're like, Angeline is so annoying. But she's a lot like Christine. And I think it is maybe a less subtle version of Christine. I think maybe it's better written in Slightly Dangerous, but I still love Angeline. I love her.
She's so, like,
she reminds me of the Courtney Milan heroine with the bad dresses. Which one is that?
The Heiress Effect.
But again, in the Heiress Effect, that heroine is doing it kind of as a defense mechanism to get people, like, away from her.
So she's trying to be outrageous.
Angeline just earnestly likes bad clothes.
And she just fully embraces it. She's like, this is what I like. And I think what was so funny is because, like, I remember I read this book. I read The Secret Mistress, like, I think right as or right after you read it. And then Emma was like, yeah, she sees him and she's like, that's my husband. And I'm like, oh, cute. And then I was reading it and I'm like, oh, that's literal. Oh, she literally does that. Yes. Like, it was really funny.
Yes. They have a great meet cute in an inn that is just very, she's like, that's my husband. And he's like, that's the most annoying woman in London.
He's like, I gotta stay.
And the whole book is
I gotta stay away from her. Like,
I feel it's like so the rom-commy elements is kind of makes a lot of sense to me if your stakes are stop embarrassing me. And I feel like this comes up a lot when people say that they don't like a third act breakup and they think it's pointless. But to me, I'm like, that's essential because you need to test the relationship. Like, you need to know this relationship has staying power. So I feel like the overtop rom-com, like, embarrassing aspects of it are, like, testing the relationship, like, making sure that they have merit, like, they do make sense together, that the starchy character still likes the heroine despite all of it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Do y'all have anything else you wanted to say about this category? Do you want to...
I don't know. I feel like we could talk about Balog a lot.
I feel like we could talk about... Yeah, I feel like we could talk about her for a long time.
Yeah, She loves the starchy character. She does write some starchy women as well. Yeah. I think that's just her favorite dynamic, I think, is starchy person and someone being undone. Like, that's also a lot of the Bedouins, too, because even when the Bedouins are not starchy themselves, they always have, like, Wulfric in their brain, like, what is acceptable? Like, Wulfric is my, like, overarching worldview, which is great. I mean, you can definitely read Slightly Dangerous on your own, which I think is what Beth and Chels both did. But if you read it in order, you get this, like, big buildup to, like, Wulfric's book, and it's... The payoff is great. But you do have to read all five Bedouins, and some of them are not as good. But the Wulfric's moments are always great.
Yeah. I wonder if you gender flip this, do you think, like, Martha from A Lady Awakened would fall into this category?
She's definitely my example of, like, starchy woman.
She's, like, the starchiest woman character I think I've ever read, and I adore her. But I'm trying to think of, like, does she think that Theo is embarrassing?
I think that part of that is that, like, I wonder if there's, like, less public interaction in a historical where the woman is starchy. Like, because it's like, that's the thing. I think if they were in public together more often,
That's true.
As a couple, it would be more embarrassing, but I don't know.
They're alone for almost the whole book. Like, they're in her bedroom. She's a different type of starchy.
Yes.
But A Christmas Gone Perfectly Wrong, that's, I mean, that's, again, is that's not gender flipped, but that's a stop embarrassing me.
Oh, for sure.
And but even though they're alone too, he's just is so easily embarrassed.
Everything embarrasses him. I love, Cecilia Grant is so good at this type of character. And then I love that I read A Lady Awakened before I read A Christmas Gone Perfectly Wrong, because then I got to have that moment of being like, because the hero of A Christmas Gone Perfectly Wrong is Martha's older brother. And I was like, that's where she gets it from. Like, that makes so much more sense to me. Like, him and a governess, like a very stern governess, like just like made Martha the woman she was. Okay, so now we're going to get into our final category. It's called rigid belief systems. So this final category was the hardest to define, probably because it can be broadly applied to characters that aren't starchy, and other types of starchy heroes fall under this as well. So it's kind of our catch-all. When we went through all the books in this category, the commonality is that the heroes have a built-in belief system that is incompatible with how they perceive their love interest.
Okay, so the first book in this category is The Soldier Scoundrel by Kat Sebastian. This is set in Regency London. Oliver is the second son of an earl. He discovers his sister Charlotte paid Jack, a fixer, £200 for an unknown reason. Oliver demands to know what it was for, and then kind of insinuates himself into Jack's next meeting with this new client who is being blackmailed. They then take the case on together. For Jack, it's his literal job, which is why he's doing it, but for Oliver, he lacks any purpose in life now that he's no longer a soldier. So after his decade of soldiering, Oliver wants a rigid set of rules that everyone in England should abide by. I think the crux of the conflict is summed up in this quote from the book, and this is from Oliver's perspective. As if it wasn't bad enough that Charlotte had some sinister goings-on with Jack, now it seemed ladies all over Mayfair turned to him for help. Oliver hardly knew what to think. For a moment, he wasn't in the heart of civilized London, but rather in a stinking battlefield in Spain, where decent people were revealed to be monsters. And this is in stark contrast to Jack, who kind of considers such attempts at rigid morality as something like only rich people can afford to have. For much of the book, Oliver constantly questions how far Jack would go for his clients. He wonders if murder is off or on the table. There's this constant tension between them where neither will fully commit to the other because of how differently they see the world. It's not until Oliver reevaluates this rigid morality that he can more fully address Jack's class difference objections to their relationship. And then the next book is False Colors by Alex Beecroft. And the book starts with John being awarded captaincy of the HMS Meteor. Alfie comes from another ship as a lieutenant. They're sent on a suicide mission meant to disrupt the slave trade in Algiers. John can tell something's different about Alfie, but can't quite figure out what it is. Alfie is attracted to John, yet treads carefully. After they actually survive their mission and lots of other plot, Alfie opens up to John. He talks about his time on the HMS Britannia, his previous boat, and his unrequited love for its captain, Charles Ferrant. He hopes this might help John realize some of his own feelings, but John doesn't react well. Alfie leaves on the strength of John's reaction before they can really talk about it more. Alfie applies for a transfer back to the HMS Britannia, and the Navy demotes John for doing his job too well, basically. John grew up with a Quaker mother who pushed extreme religious piety and a father who embarrassed his son. So this is a quote from John's perspective. My father is Church of England, naturally, and so in theory am I. In truth, however, I'm some mixture peculiar to myself. If one collapsed from the most permissive church in the world, my father managed it. It isn't given to every son to be embarrassed by the ridiculous behavior of his parent. Yet, when he brought his whores and actresses to the house, I was still a child. I would creep from my bed downstairs to listen to the music through the closed doors of the ballroom. And if I would be switched soundly for it in the morning, all that achieved was to give it a certain illicit thrill. It could not be stopped. So I find John Starchiness not as straightforward, but it's definitely coming from his parents who presented these two extremes of behavior.
Yeah, so it was kind of interesting when we were putting these categories together, like the ones in this one, both are queer books.
I think it just adds this extra layer to navigate that is not as like easy as just like, hey, give up those rules and just like fully embrace your identity, because sodomy is criminalized. Like there, and that's like the crux of False Colors. Eventually, Alfie, I can't even remember how this happens, but he does get charged with buggery. And basically, the last part of the book. Yeah, it's horrifying. And it's the last part of the book is John, like, behind the scenes, like, trying to help Alfie not die, like, not get hanged for this.
Oh, I was just thinking about, like, this, like, compared to the, it is interesting, like, what, I mean, we just picked different books, but, like, what plays out, but the, this one, like, the bodyguard one with the, like, interracial couples, or not even interracial, but, like, having black heroines, the sort of externalized, like, working with the system of different identities. I was thinking, with these, it's like, you have this identity that can be criminalized, but it's like internal, and you have to decide whether you're going to act on it or not. Like that's its own sort of type of plot. It's not like an empathy exercise anymore, or like a trust exercise, like listening to your partner of like what their reality is. It's like, do I like listen to my own identity and accept a new reality that would be like, could criminalize my life? Like that's a big theme. We talked about how Think of England, a K.J. Charles book that we all read recently, sort of also fits under this umbrella, like that fear of criminalization, like the starchiness is no longer just like a worldview. It's a worldview that like everyone adopts about this behavior, that there are rules about what is acceptable queer behavior, what is not acceptable queer behavior, who has to follow the rules, what class you're in, that's, it's no longer just like a quirk of a personality. It's a reality all around you.
Yeah. It's no longer like really a personal thing. Like, and so I guess kind of when you say like gets unstarched, like it's kind of has, it complicates it and it gives it kind of a lot more layers to it than just being like, oh, I was embarrassed by you. Now I'm no longer embarrassed by you. It's like, oh, we're still living in this world where like we're going to be treated this way. We have to tread carefully with certain types of people. We need to be more cognizant of things. But ultimately, like I'm going to put my faith in my partner and that we're going to do our best to make it work despite this extra added layer of things to worry about.
I think another thing I really liked about The Soldier Scoundrel, obviously this is like one of my favorite books. I'm sure everyone on this podcast is done with me talking about it.
It's so good.
It is so good. It's just one of my comfort reads as well. But I do really like that Jack does challenge Oliver's rigid reaction. Like, I think it doesn't downplay Oliver's experience being a soldier and kind of seeing, like, as he puts it, like the worst parts of humanity. But there is like a part of the book where he kind of does have to reckon with it, where he like is talking to someone else and trying to comfort that person and like shares some of his own past to kind of like help this other person who's also done a horrible thing. But I think it helps him recognize that, like, I don't know, it's not as straightforward, it's not as black and white, and you can't like impose these rules on everyone because the rules are not equal for everyone.
I think too, this is about False Colors and like the religious angle of it.
Yes.
I think there's like not, I wish this is, like, every time it happens in a historical romance, I'm like delighted by it because it feels like so grounding and like true to life that like what like sect of Protestantism you are in is so such a big part of like your worldview in England at the time. So like that you have this like Quaker background or Church of England background, or if you're like Presbyterian or Calvinist, like all these things like matter to your worldview. But I think a lot of a few different books that I thought of as like we were going through like starchy people getting unstarched, that sort of, I think it works really well when there is like a religious background, because it's just this like operating worldview that is often like a comfort thing for people. Like sometimes it's like, oh, like the people who are like, stop embarrassing me, it's a personality quirk. But again, here it's like, this is your framework for like how you exist in your life and how you like think of yourself as a good person. I think it almost connects more to like the political heroes we were talking about, where it's like they have to define themselves by their good works. Like if you fit into this worldview of like a religion, it's like, oh, I'm good because I'm good under this system. And if I'm not good under the system, like, what am I? And you get really untethered from that, like, truth. But yeah, there were a few different, like, I was thinking of the Scarlet Peckham with the priest. Oh, he's not, yes, a priest. He's a minister. But that one is very, like, that's that's like very starchy hero, gets very unstarched very quickly. But through his religion, like it is a big part of the plot and like what he, how he adopts sort of like his happily ever after.
Yeah.
The Lord I Left. That's what it's called. Yes.
When I was thinking about false colors too, in this and that, like, I don't really know what to do with this observation. It just makes it so, the whole book, like, so much more like bittersweet and like kind of like hard to grapple with. This book is very good, but it's like, it's a tough one. It's really, in any case, like Alfie, when he like initially gets on the ship, like Alfie is like, I got on this ship because I like John. I want to be around John. He doesn't love John.
Yeah. I like looking at him.
he's like, I want to be around him. That sounds like a great ship for me. So Alfie's like in this, he's like pursuing his pleasure. He's like pursuing his joy. He's like a very happy, fun guy. But Alfie is also the one who gets in huge trouble. Whereas like John kind of has these rules about himself that he kind of like is less open, less public. He doesn't try things until like halfway through the book. But John is the one who has to save Alfie. And like, I don't really know what to do with this observation that like, I think it kind of makes it more complicated because like starchy hero gets unstarched. Like we're kind of like moralizing it a little bit. Like you're becoming a better person through this. And that's, it's a little bit more complicated in some of these books where it's just kind of like a change of living, putting something before something else. Like for John, it's like he's lonely. He's got a very sad, lonely life. Like he wants something like that, and he wants Alfie to be okay. And he thinks that those are competing interests, because for most of the book, they are competing interests.
Yeah, for so many of these heroes, it's like the unstarching, they effectively lose nothing and gain everything. Like Wulfric, he could unstarch himself at any time and nothing would happen. Like he's the Duke of Bedwin. Everyone is talking about how powerful he is all the time. Christine is a catalyst for it, but it's entirely an internal battle for him. But when you get into either the characters who are not white, characters who are queer, characters who are not noble, they have more to lose, and the stakes become higher. So this phrase of starchy hero becomes unstarched feels like a very internal process, but there are external consequences for some characters, even though if like the hallmark example is someone who's no consequences.
So do y'all have any final thoughts about starchy heroes? Any last words?
Yeah, I wonder if I do think this is a hero type that we're losing, or like is not in like the, it's not in the first level of like things that people recommend in historical romance. Like Julia Quinn doesn't write starchy heroes. Tessa Dare doesn't write starchy heroes. Like those sort of like wallpapery first like Google search historical romance, I don't associate them with this character type, but it is one that's like very baked into the genre and is a lot in lots of great books. So I don't know if we're losing it because we're getting so many rakes, but bring them back. I love them.
Wulfric forever.
Yeah.
Supremacy.
Other books that we've talked about before, and this is in the script that Chelsea added, but I just wanted everyone to know, we've talked about Unmasked by the Marquess. Marquess.
I don't understand.
That episode
how
is going to haunt us.
Can it just be Marquis? Let's stick with the French way.
Marquis is so hard to say.
I know.
Well, it's because you're trying to make it two syllables too much. It's like Marquess. Like Marquess. Say Marquess. Yes.
Yeah.
You're going Marquess.
Yeah, Marquess. It's hard.
We've also talked about The Jade Temptress, which feels like one of the more recent books. Emma says this is kind of going out of Vogue, but I feel like Jade Temptress is kind of more recent.
Yeah, that was.
Yeah, that's like one of the things that makes that book work as like a cop romance is how starchy he is.
Yeah. Ruin of a Rake, which is another Cat Sebastian, is the third book in the Turners series, and Julian's the starchy one. Courtney is the rake who gets trying to patch his reputation. And then Ruined by Rumor by Alyssa Everett. Maybe our youngest, like we were talking about before, maybe our youngest starchy character.
I don't remember why he's so starchy, but he is starchy.
I think it's just he's like in love with
I think it's Roxanne? Like awkwardness mostly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's like a social awkwardness that's just like playing out as like, and his discomfort. He doesn't know how to talk to women. And I honestly think a lot of his starchiness is just like people projecting that onto him.
Well, so, also he had like a brother who died really young, right? So I feel like he needs to be the best at what he's doing because he like lost his brother. So he like works super hard and is just like, anyway.
And then we just recorded to.
Oh, yeah. Midsummer Moon.
Midsummer Moon. And then Think of England.
Yeah. Think of England.
We even chatted about Starchy Heroes and that. So hopefully these, we don't know what order these will be in. So if it's confusing, that's why.
Yes. It'll be coming out soon.
Yeah. Definitely a Reformed Rake's favorite type of hero. Thank you so much for listening to Reformed Rake's. If you enjoy the podcast, you can find bonus content on our Patreon at patreon.com/reformedrakes. We'll have more Starchy Hero recommendations there too. Please rate and review us on Apple and Spotify. It helps a lot. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram for show updates. The username for both is @reformedrakes. Thank you again, and we'll see you next time.